This episode features discussion of kidnapping, murder, and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. His crew was safe. At least he had that, Richard Phillips thought.
3 days prior, Captain Richard Phillips had been supervising routine maintenance checks and emergency drills on the cargo ship he captained, the Maersk, Alabama.
Now he was trapped in a lifeboat in the middle of the ocean, a hostage of 4 Somali pirates. It was close to midnight now. The moon was out. They'd been on the lifeboat at least 36 hours.
The pirates were probably thinking their day had taken a wrong turn as well. Phillips could see it in the frustrated face of the lead pirate, Abdulali Musi. Musi thought to himself, this was supposed to be an easy job. The American crew wasn't supposed to fight back. Musi winced at the nasty cut on his hand. A present from the ship's chief engineer, Mike Perry, flared up.
For a moment, hostage and captors shared a look. Hell of a day, right?
Phillips asked if he could pee. The lifeboat had no toilet. He'd have to pee off the side of the boat.
The oldest pirate, Adi Auden Elmi, gave a grudging nod and escorted Phillips outside the lifeboat's covered area to its edge.
And that's when Richard Phillips suddenly elbowed Elmi into the water and dove into the ocean, swimming desperately towards the nearby Navy ship.
Then he heard the machine gun fire. They're shooting, he thought, as he swam frantically away from the lifeboat. Oh God, they're still shooting. They can't shoot me. They have no leverage if I'm dead. But the gunfire continued. Phillips swam like he'd never swum before.
This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We also delve into psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations, as well as explore the psychological toll captivity takes on the human brain.
We're your hosts. I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy. You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen. This is our first episode on the capture of the Maersk, Alabama, an American cargo ship whose crew was taken hostage by Somali pirates on April 8, 2009.
We'll also cover Captain Richard Phillips, whom the Somali pirates took hostage when their takeover of the Maersk failed, and they had to escape in a lifeboat. And we'll follow Phillips' 5-day ordeal on that lifeboat after he and his crew successfully bluffed, tricked, and eventually forced the 4 pirates off the Maersk.
If you had the misfortune to be born in Somalia after its government collapsed in 1991, your options were limited to a crushing degree.
Abdulali Musi had a particularly hard life. He was born in Puntland, Somalia. In either 1990 or 1993, the Federal Bureau of Prison says 1990. His parents say 1993. Musi grew up in constant hunger, often without clothes. He was kicked by a camel as a child and lost 2 front teeth as a result, giving him a distinctive grin.
By age 11 or 12, he was living on his own and working as a taxi driver, but he was trampled by cows and severely injured.
At the age of 13, Musi moved to Garaad, Somalia, in search of better opportunities. At that point, Garaad had already become a piracy hub.
Somalia once had a relatively healthy fishing industry. Its long coastline bordered the Indian Ocean, and tuna, sardines, and mackerel were plentiful. But when the government collapsed, foreign ships moved in on Somalia's undefended coastline to reap the harvest.
This cost Somalia tens of millions of dollars a year and robbed Somali fishermen of their livelihoods. The fishermen soon struck back, getting on small, rundown motorboats called skiffs to defend their fish.
And then Somali warlords realized that the undefended coastline could work in their favor. They started organizing fishermen to attack foreign boats, capture them, and hold the crew for ransom. The pirates had a problem, however. The skiffs could only get a few miles from the coastline. The ships under attack simply changed their routes so they'd be out of reach.
But then the Somali pirates hit upon a brilliant strategy. Steal a single freighter ship first, attack it with their skiffs, board it, and take control of it.
Once they stole a freighter, they could use the freighter as a mothership. The mothership would tow the small skiffs hundreds of miles. Then, once within range of a ship, the pirates would take the skiffs out on an attack.
You have to give it to the pirates. It was an ingenious strategy. All of a sudden, the pirates were no longer restricted by distance or time. They could stay at sea for several weeks thanks to the mothership.
It was into this world, where piracy was the best chance to make any kind of money, that the 13-year-old Abduwali Musi entered. The mental toughness Musi must have had at this age is unimaginable. A study from Cornell University shows that impoverished children had more antisocial conduct, including aggression and bullying.
Musi's mind games with Phillips would certainly qualify as bullying, and his turn to piracy, endangering the lives of innocent sailors, certainly qualifies as aggressive and antisocial.
And then again, those qualities also made him a great pirate.
Musi began as a simple cook for fishermen. In 2008, when he was either 16 or 18, he married a girl named Basra, but he couldn't afford to establish a home for themselves. Piracy would have been an enticing option, especially with so many comparatively rich ships traveling the Somali coast.
By 2009, those ships all knew that piracy was a problem. Captain Richard Phillips was even more aware than most. It was April 1st, 2009, and his email inbox was full of warnings from the American Office of Naval Intelligence about the Somali coast.
Unfortunately, that was exactly the route the cargo ship he was captaining, the Maersk Alabama, would have to take on its journey. The Maersk Alabama would leave the port of Salalah, Oman, travel southwest to stop off at Djibouti, and then travel further south, circling around the coast of Somalia, until the ship reached its final destination of Mombasa, Kenya. Richard Phillips had captained this route before, and he usually found it relaxing.
It was the fastest possible route, and while fully aware of the piracy threat, the shipping company couldn't afford any delay delivering its supplies. Beyond that, American companies felt a certain invincibility. No American ship had been taken by pirates since the 1800s, more than 200 years ago. Freighter captains rotate from ship to ship. They don't have one ship they captain regularly, and most of Phillips' crew were new to him. But Shane Murphy, his chief mate and second in command, was a familiar face.
Shane Murphy and Richard Phillips had a mutual respect for one another. Both were no-nonsense men who believed in drills and preparation. More than that, Phillips believed Shane had the makings of a future captain.
On April 1st, 2009, almost as soon as they were on board, Phillips had Murphy run surprise drills on any situation that might occur. Fire drills, man overboard drills, and yes, piracy drills.
Navy SEALs frequently referenced the quote that in a combat situation, you don't rise to the level of your opponent, you sink to the level of your training, originally from ancient Greek poet Archilochus. In a life-endangering situation, instinct can take over and the body goes into fight, flight, or freeze mode. But if you've been trained and mentally prepared, your training takes over.
You're less likely to freeze or flee.
Another big believer in training was the ship's chief engineer, Mike Perry. Perry was an ex-Navy man and born-again Christian in his 50s. Phillips respected Perry considerably.
Both Perry and Phillips knew that ships didn't have good ways of dealing with pirates. By 2009, it was known among the pirates that shipping companies were perfectly willing to pay ransom.
Richard Phillips was generally regarded as tough but fair. He had captained ships for almost 20 years. While he had never encountered pirates, he'd been through near-death experiences at sea before. Once, he had four ribs cracked and a lung collapsed when a crate got loose during a storm.
He was a sturdy, tough-minded, and resourceful New England native, one of the last captains you'd want to target if you were trying to take a boat as a pirate.
But he and every other sailor on board the Maersk Alabama were unarmed. For liability reasons, most cargo ships did not have guns on board.
In 2009, merchant ships were outmatched by pirates. The pirates were known to carry automatic weapons and grenades. The boats had to rely on their wits, luck, fire hoses, and the occasional flare.
In retrospect, it seems like American ships had just had good luck up until now, because Somali pirates were attacking ships indiscriminately. Tankers, fishing ships, luxury cruise ships. The pirates couldn't detect the nationality of the ships. They looked for ships that were isolated from other ships, and the attacks could turn deadly for passengers and crews.
The film, Captain Phillips, suggests that Abduwali Musi was forced into piracy by Somali warlords, but interviews with those who know him strongly indicate that he chose piracy himself and enjoyed it.
Mohammed Syed, a former classmate of Musi, said that Musi had always wanted to become a pirate. Quote, "He used to talk about ransoms paid all the time," said Syed. And given the harsh living conditions of Somalia, there must have been something appealing about the endless open water.
Sometime in early April, Musi selected his crew. Adi Aden Elmi, a tall and experienced 34-year-old with a wife and children, the 29-year-old Hamak, and a young man who looked to be around 16 or 17.
The young man has never been identified in an English-language newspaper. Phillips would call him Young Guy.
Adi Aden Elmi, the oldest of the pirates Musi chose, and the only one with children, had brought home stolen property before. The money from that meant he could feed his kids. But his wife had started to ask questions about where the money was coming from. She didn't want him doing anything illegal.
Elmi wanted to say to her that that didn't leave many options in Somalia. With a haul from a ship this size, his family could eat for months.
Hamak had no wife, but he wanted to make sure to provide for his mother. Hamak seemed reliable and solid at first, but when the attack on the Maersk went south, he turned aggressive and dangerous.
The fourth and youngest pirate must have been filled with adrenaline. This may have been his first attempt at piracy, and they'd gotten on board. Piles of money surely awaited them.
Neither Richard Phillips nor Abduwali Musi knew that their actions had placed them on a collision course, a course that was to test both men to their limits, one that would eventually prove fatal. Up next, we'll track that course.
Now, back to the story. On April 7th, 2009, the Maersk Alabama left Djibouti for the most dangerous part of its trip, the journey around the Somali coastline. At 1:40 p.m., Captain Phillips spotted three blips on the ship's radar, 7 miles away, but moving rapidly towards the Maersk Alabama.
Phillips then spotted a larger blip 8 miles away, the mothership. It was following the Maersk precisely. Phillips immediately radioed Shane Murphy. Possible pirate approach. Thanks to Richard Phillips himself, we have an almost blow-by-blow account of the pirate's attack published in his memoir, A Captain's Duty.
The strange thing was the time, 1:40 p.m., Pirates' typical strategy was to attack either right after sunrise or immediately before sunset, when visibility was lowest. Had the pirates made an error? Were they being too impulsive?
Phillips didn't think so. Pirates changed their game plan a lot. This might be a deliberate new twist in their plan of attack. Given the pirates' constant innovation and changing tactics, that seems likely. An attack in broad daylight might intimidate the crew of a ship and get under their skin psychologically. Phillips contacted Chief Engineer Perry and ordered him to speed up. He then called the closest thing international boats had to 911, the United Kingdom Marine Trade Operations, which could notify other ships about the attack.
Astonishingly, the UK MTO was not sympathetic. Direct quote, "We have a lot of captains who are nervous out there," end quote.
Phillips dialed the U.S. emergency line for piracy. But worse yet, no one picked up. The Maersk Alabama was on its own.
The three small ships were closing fast. 5 miles. Four. But the Maersk had one small piece of luck on its side. It was headed further offshore, and the waves were getting larger.
Phillips and the crew members on the bridge could see the skiffs were only 5 miles away, but they were running into trouble. The waves were sending the skiff sideways, forcing them to slow down. Suddenly, it was a game of cat and mouse, with the Maersk as the mouse.
3 p.m. More than an hour had gone by, and the skiffs had slowly closed the distance to 3 miles away. They'd be within boarding range of the Maersk within 90 minutes. Something had to be done.
Richard Phillips got on the radio and radioed to Coalition Warship 237, a military naval vessel, requesting immediate assistance.
Phillips knew the pirates might be listening to the Maersk Alabama's radio transmission. They were that well prepared. So if they'd had a radio tuned to the Maersk Alabama frequency, they would have heard Phillips request help from the warship. They would have then heard the warship respond. What the pirates didn't know is that Phillips was doing both voices. Coalition Warship 237 did not exist.
Coalition Warship 237 replied that it had a helicopter en route and would be there within 5 minutes. And suddenly, the crew saw the mothership drop off the radar, along with two of the three small skiffs.
Pirates looked for easy, straightforward hauls. Most of the pirates did not want to deal with a warship, let alone a helicopter. A cargo vessel defended by a helicopter was the opposite of easy.
But the final skiff, Musi's skiff, was still coming hard. Abdulwali Musi must have been frustrated by the two other skiffs turning around, but he was not going to be scared off by a helicopter that wasn't even visible yet. There was time.
Musi closed in, less than a mile away from the Maersk. And then, facing more big waves without the rest of his crew, Musi's skiff and the four pirates on board peeled away. It must have been infuriating to come so close to a vessel and then have to give up the chase.
The Maersk Alabama had dodged a bullet. Its crew had performed well, maneuvering the ship and speeding it up, but it had also gotten lucky.
That night, with the crew exhilarated but also nervous, Phillips went over some ground rules in the event that they were taken hostage. 1. Don't mention religion. It will only antagonize the pirates. 2. Don't discuss politics and don't argue if the pirates say America's terrible.
In a worst-case scenario, you want to build rapport with the pirates, and arguing with them is not a good way to do that. Phillips continued to list off rules. 3. Do whatever they tell you, but give them as little information as possible.
There were little pieces of information you could reveal to them, called giveaways, that would not endanger the ship or crew. Show them how to get fresh water while on board the ship. Get them familiar with the safety equipment.
Meanwhile, keep the pirates away from the important stuff, the holdbacks. Make sure they can't use the radar or the engine controls. It was a masterclass in how to deal with hostage takers.
The next morning, April 8th, brought a hot, sunny dawn. One of Phillips' crew, a Pakistani man whose real first name was ATM, spotted the ship first.
3 miles away, a white skiff, possibly the same one as the day before, was moving towards the Maersk Alabama. It was just after dawn and visibility was limited. The sea had calmed down. There would be no escaping the skiff this time.
Captain Phillips ordered the Maersk Alabama to change course by 50 degrees, from 230 degrees southwest to 180 degrees due south. And the skiff changed course as well to pursue. No question, one of the skiffs from yesterday had come back.
Colin, the third mate, sounded the intruder alarm. 4 whistle blasts, long, short, long, short.
Then, the general alarm.
The first line of defense for the Maersk Alabama was the fire hoses. Several fire hoses hung straight down from the Maersk in key positions around the boat and could pump out water at 100 pounds per square inch.
Phillips had the crew switch their onboard person-to-person radios, which were basically walkie-talkies, to Channel 1, the emergency channel, and third mate Colin got ready with the flares. The question on everyone's mind was, where was the mothership?
For that matter, where were the other 2 skiffs from yesterday? If the mothership showed up, the pirates could get 25 armed marauders on board. Game over. As it stood, the skiff had just 4 armed pirates.
Perhaps Moosey was simply more daring than his comrades, or more determined. He had been leading the boat that had gotten closest to the Maersk the day before, April 7th.
It's possible he couldn't resist another shot at what looked like a big prize. Whatever the reason, thanks to Phillips' bluff, the Maersk was about to deal with only 4 pirates instead of 12, which would eventually prove to be decisive in the crew's ability to retake the ship.
The pirates had gotten less than a half mile away, and they were shooting at the boat. Bullets rammed into the ship. Captain Phillips, Colin Wright, and a few crew members on the bridge had to duck down below the bridge's windows. The rest of the crew moved to their assigned locations, just like they had been trained.
Many crew were headed to the safe room. Chief Engineer Mike Perry and his team locked themselves in the engine room. The first and third engineers got to the aft steering room.
Shane Murphy and Captain Phillips, dodging potentially lethal machine gun fire, aimed their flares at the skiff. If one of them could just get a flare on the small skiff and hit a gas can, the skiff would explode. They fired their flares.
And again.
And a third time. The flares distracted the pirates, but none of them scored a direct shot.
The Maersk was changing direction as the skiff got closer and closer, engaging in racing maneuvers. The idea was to shift the boat back and forth to make it much harder for the pirates to get a rope ladder or a grappling hook on board.
But Abdulali Moosey had other ideas. You always had to be innovating, stay one step ahead of your targets. Why bring an unstable rope ladder when you could use a sturdy, solid metal ladder?
The pirates, to Phillips and the crew's astonishment, raised a metal pool ladder with hooks that could easily land on the side of the Maersk. It may have been the first time a solid ladder was used in a pirate attack.
The pirates found a gap in the hoses, matched the zigzagging of the ship, raised the ladder, and snagged the Maersk. Moosey clambered up the ladder and was on board.
Moosey stabilized the ladder so the other pirates could board and hauled up a bucket, which held his machine gun.
He fired shots from his AK-47 at the visible bridge and Phillips, as if sending a message, "We're coming, don't screw with us."
Richard Phillips had 2 choices at the moment. He could give up the bridge, retreat to the safe room, and outwait the pirates, or he could hang onto the bridge. Phillips was stubborn. He chose to stay on the bridge.
In retrospect, Phillips thinks this was a mistake, but it may have given him the opportunity to bond with his future captors and to eventually help his men retake the Maersk Alabama. But at this point, the question was now moot.
All 4 heavily armed pirates were now on board and headed for the bridge. How could Phillips protect his crew and get the pirates off the ship safely?
Up next, we'll find out how he did and what went wrong, escalating things to an extent that nearly cost Phillips his life.
Now back to the story. Captain Richard Phillips, third mate Colin, and the Pakistani ATM were on the bridge, waiting for the 4 pirates.
The Maersk Alabama had pirate cages, locked doors, securing ladders and doorways to get from the deck to the bridge. But the pirates were calmly and methodically shooting their way through the locks.
Abdulwali Musi must have been thrilled. He had gotten on board the ship safely with his crew of three. Yes, it was unfortunate that the other two skiffs hadn't chosen to accompany him, but as he looked up into the sky, he couldn't help but notice the complete lack of helicopters.
I was right, he thought. Commercial ships didn't have helicopters, or the Navy come to protect them. Well, more glory for him, and more money as well.
It was 7:35 a.m. Musi shot the lock off the bridge door and walked onto the bridge. At only 5 feet 2 inches tall, he might not have cut a commanding figure initially, but most people become commanding when they're holding a machine gun. Relax, Captain, relax, he said. Business, just business. Stop the ship.
It was important for Musi to immediately establish control of the situation. It would help prevent any crew rebellion. And once assured that this operation was strictly business, the unarmed crew would be unlikely to fight back. Everything on board was insured.
Richard Phillips, meanwhile, simultaneously tried to establish a rapport with the pirates and gum up the works. Remarkably, he was able to do both. He'd quietly used his radio to instruct the chief engineer to take control of the ship's steering. If the pirates had control of the steering, they could take the entire ship and its crew to Somalia and then hold the crew for ransom on land, where it'd be much harder to rescue them. Preventing that was Phillips' first order of business.
But Phillips didn't want to reveal to the pirates yet that they didn't have control. So he secretly used his radio to notify the chief engineer to stop the ship while making it look like he was the one doing the steering.
The Maersk Alabama was dead in the water, with no one around for help.
This is where Phillips introduced a new element, pretending he was incompetent. Ship's broken, he explained to Musi. You broke the ship when you made me stop too fast.
Musi was an experienced sailor, but he didn't know the workings of American ships. For the moment, he had to assume Phillips was telling the truth.
Phillips' next job was to further impede the pirates as he moved around the bridge, pretending to try to get the Maersk Alabama going again. He quickly fiddled with the radar, turning the anti-rain and anti-sea clutter knobs all the way up.
Well, normally, those screened out ocean waves and precipitation, but by turning the knobs all the way up on a sunny, calm day, Phillips had effectively rendered the radar useless, at least temporarily. That way, if the Navy did come to save the Maersk, the pirates wouldn't see the ships coming on the radar.
Phillips didn't know yet if this was true for Abdulwali Musi, but he knew Somali pirates often had past sailing experience. They might be able to get the radar working. So Richard Phillips turned next to disabling the radio.
Phillips switched the ship's radio from the standard channel 16 to channel 72, a channel nobody used. If the pirates didn't spot the switch, they would not be able to contact the mothership. The pirates had to be prevented from contacting the mothership at all costs, or else the entire crew could be overpowered and taken hostage. Against just 4 pirates, the Maersk Alabama crew had a chance of hiding and outlasting them.
The alarms blared, and Phillips silenced them. There wasn't a purpose to them at this point. Musi attempted to play good cop, bad cop, claiming he was just the other pirates' interpreter and that the other pirates would kill them. They're crazy, he yelled.
Phillips, Colin, and ATM didn't believe for a second that Musi was an interpreter. He was carrying a machine gun and had been first on board. But they could see he was more stable than his fellow pirates.
Phillips tapped into the ship's PA system and requested that all crew report to the bridge, secretly hoping none would. Meanwhile, while Musi was distracted, Phillips gave the crew more details about the pirates' location and weapons.
Longtime FBI negotiator Chris Voss has written that in a hostage situation, you shouldn't be too confrontational to your captors, but you also shouldn't be too meek. Maintain your dignity was a line that came to Phillips' head. Stay in the middle. Stay in your line.
First things first, Phillips got Moosey's permission to get the other pirates some fresh water, and then he remembered that tobacco was hugely popular in Africa.
Phillips already had cartons of cigarettes on the bridge for bribes to foreign port officials, so he gave the pirates a bunch of smokes. They seemed at least mildly appreciative, but they were still waving their guns around.
Moosey casually asked Phillips what nationality the ship was. Phillips told them American, and the pirates' eyes lit up. America! They'd hit the jackpot.
Before most of the crew had retreated to their various safe locations, Chief Mate Shane Murphy had notified the UKMTO that they were being taken by pirates. Delay would help the Maersk Alabama crew.
With Moosey unable to raise the mothership on the radio, he demanded a cell phone, so Phillips got the satellite phone.
This was bad. The pirates reaching the mothership would change the equation completely.
Phillips couldn't deliberately misdial the number because the phone number was clearly displayed, but Phillips' quick thinking helped the crew again.
On most satellite phones, there is one final key you have to hit to send the call. Phillips withheld this information, and Moosey was none the wiser. "Phone broken," Phillips said. "No cell coverage."
Moosey turned next to the radar. This had become a slow battle of wills between him and the captain, a chess match where neither party could see the other's board or pieces.
To Phillips' surprise, Moosey was familiar with radar. He requested a 72-mile scale, which would increase the range of the radar. Phillips knew then that the pirates had chosen their leader well. Moosey had training.
But not enough training to recognize how Phillips had hobbled the radar. And surprisingly, the pirates had not had the presence of mind to take away Phillips' walkie-talkie radio. This was already helping the crew even the odds.
Every person on that bridge knew that if the pirates' tempers flared, or if something unexpected happened, they could start shooting.
Colin Wright, Phillips' third mate, reminded him that they had $30,000 in the safe precisely for emergencies that they could give the pirates. But Phillips pointed out that the pirates would want much more than 30 grand.
Phillips, Wright, and ATM were all monitoring the pirates' moods carefully, especially Moosey. The other pirates seemed to take their emotional cues from Moosey. If he was agitated, so were they. But if he calmed down, the pirates relaxed as well.
They also knew they had to be very careful. The pirates had a lot less to lose than they did, and almost certainly did not fear death.
It was now 9 a.m. on April 8th, 2009. The pirates had been on board for 1 hour and 25 minutes. Between the radar, the satellite phone not working, and the crew not appearing, Moosey was probably getting suspicious, and he would have wanted to establish control.
"Bring all the crew up," he screamed. "You have 2 minutes, or these guys will kill you."
Two of the other pirates pointed their AK-47s at ATM and Colin. "You want to die?"
Phillips tried to calm the pirates down. He got on the PA system and said, quote, "Report to bridge immediately, crew. The pirates want you on the bridge now."
The pirates began counting down. Elmy, the oldest one, yelled out, 1 minute 30, and then 1 minute.
Resisting demands in a normal hostage situation when you're unarmed and your captors are armed is exceedingly dangerous and not recommended.
30 seconds, yelled Elmy.
Then the pirates made a crucial error. Moosey demanded that Phillips bring the crew up to the bridge or he'd blow up the ship. He said he had a bomb. But this was crazy. They clearly weren't going to blow up the ship when it represented a ransom of millions of dollars. And Phillips had seen the buckets. They had AK-47s, but they did not have a bomb.
2 minutes passed. The pirates didn't blow up the ship with their non-existent bomb, and they also didn't shoot anyone with their very real guns.
In retrospect, the crew calling the pirates' bluff worked. The pirates were not going to kill anybody, not when most of the crew were hidden and might retaliate.
But many kidnappers are desperate, ready to die for a cause. The pirates were, at their heart, businessmen. But hostage takers with less to lose or different motivations could easily not have been bluffing and ready to murder the hostages they already had.
According to Gary Nestner, the former chief of the FBI Crisis Negotiation Unit, when dealing with a hostage situation, you want to do everything possible to diffuse the emotional situation and lower the tension. Phillips was doing the opposite.
Phillips knew that there was another ticking clock. With the power off, the cooling systems were off too. The room and aft steering, the backup safe room, would not have AC, so it would soon reach temperatures above 100 degrees in there.
If the crew stayed in there too long, heat stress would set in, dehydration, dropping blood pressure, headaches, and then chills and convulsions, and then the men would fall into comas.
But they had to stay hidden. The more live hostages, the more money the pirates stood to make, and the more likely the pirates were to escape alive.
So the Somali pirates threatened again. They'd kill someone if the crew didn't appear in 2 minutes. Phillips, Wright, and ATM were still somewhat terrified, but it was clearly a bluff the second time around.
Musi decided he had to find the crew, so he ordered Phillips to come with him. They would search the ship.
The Maersk, Alabama, had a 7-story tall structure at the back end of the ship, the stern. Sailors called it the house. The top level of the house was the bridge, which had windows all around it running down from the ceiling to 2 feet off the ground.
Each deck below the bridge was given a letter. The living quarters of the captain and the chief engineer were on E deck. Other engineers and mates' quarters, D deck. Everyone else's quarters, C deck. B deck had more room for what Phillips called the ABs, able-bodied seamen, as well as the lounges.
On A deck, you could find the mess and the hospital. Directly under the house was the engine room and cargo holds. Below that, tanks of fuel and water.
At this point, all 16 other crew members, the ones who were not Phillips, Colin Wright, and ATM, were hidden in various locations below deck.
Musi had had enough of whatever was going on. He grabbed Phillips and took him at gunpoint to search the rest of the ship.
Phillips, meanwhile, stalled for time. He wanted to figure out how to get the 3 crew members on the bridge to safety and prevent the pirates from finding the 16 hidden men. Phillips needed to keep his crew hidden for 2 reasons.
1, it was best to keep them safe. Phillips' goal at this point was simply to get the pirates off the ship with as little fuss as possible.
He knew the pirates' preferred strategy after taking over a ship was to pilot it to the coast, land it in Somalia, and hold crew members captive on land, where it would be far more difficult to rescue them.
2, the fewer hostages the pirates had access to, the less leverage they had. Musi knew this too. He wanted to find the crew to increase his leverage.
He thoroughly searched each deck, but every room was abandoned.
At this point, Phillips had no idea that the Navy would assist in his rescue. He assumed they were on their own, which, while scary, ended up being empowering for the crew.
The search proved fruitless for Musi, and the pirates had another problem. Musi switched the ship's radio from the useless Channel 72 to the commonly used Channel 16, a reminder that he was not a newcomer to the sea.
But he turned the radio on only to hear Chief Mate Shane Murphy calling in a request for helicopter air support to the Navy's USS Virginia. At least, that's what the pirates thought.
In reality, Shane Murphy was pulling exactly the same trick Richard Phillips had pulled 24 hours earlier. And this time, Musi and the other pirates were spooked.
The pirates really did not want to deal with the U.S. Navy. They had a tight plan. Take the ship. Contact the mothership. Hold the crew hostage. Get a ransom. Leave with millions of dollars. But now, the radio wasn't working. The radar didn't work at all. Most of the crew were hidden, and the Navy might be coming.
Musi ordered Phillips to search the ship with him again. Phillips made sure to keep up a constant, loud, friendly conversation with Musi as they moved around the decks. If any crew were around, they'd hear Phillips and know to hide.
While Moosey was still calm, he was treating the mystery of the missing crew like a puzzle that had to be solved. The other pirates were getting stressed out and nervous. It was past noon at this point.
The pirates wanted to search the boat again. Maybe they'd missed something. So Philip sent ATM to lead Moosey. But Moosey, possibly getting overconfident, didn't bring his gun with him. As ATM passed by, Phillips whispered to him,
"Take him to the guys."
And ATM did just that.
ATM led Moosey down into the depths of the ship to the engine room, and Chief Engineer Mike Perry, who'd been carefully listening to Phillips' guidance on the radio throughout the ordeal, was waiting for him.
With the emergency power off, the corridors were pitch black. Mike Perry waited in the engine room, holding a knife. And then Moosey swept a flashlight across the room and spotted Mike.
Mike ran for it, and Moosey chased him, screaming. Here was one crew member who wasn't going to escape him. Mike Perry knew the crew was running out of time. He ducked around the corner, standing stock still in the dark. He could hear Moosey getting closer and closer.
And when Moosey lunged around the corner, Perry brought his knife to Moosey's throat and body slammed him to the floor. ATM raced up and helped subdue Moosey.
Mike Perry waited in the darkness for gunfire. There wasn't any. ATM confirmed to a relieved Mike that Moosey was alone. Only Moosey had been injured in the fight. His hand had been badly cut and was spurting blood.
Mike Perry and ATM marched Moosey to the aft steering room where the rest of the men lay in wait. Moosey had found the ship's crew, but not the way he'd wanted to.
Mike radioed up to Richard Phillips that they'd now taken a hostage of their own. The pirates had lost their leader, but the three remaining pirates on the bridge still had their machine guns.
The job had gone south. The pirates desperately wanted a way out. Richard Phillips was happy to give it to them. If he could keep his crew and his ship and lose only $30,000, that was a major win. So he offered the pirates $30,000 so they wouldn't have to leave empty-handed.
The pirates had scuttled their own skiff after coming on board. Either they'd been overconfident or Moosey wanted to ensure his men couldn't flee empty-handed. But the pirates knew they had to get off the ship. One of them spotted the lifeboat.
This was a much sturdier craft than what we commonly think of as a lifeboat. It was covered, and it had a motor and ran on fuel.
It was at this point that Mike Perry radioed up to the bridge. "We have your leader," he said. "How about a trade?" The pirates agreed. They would give up Phillips, and the crew would give up Moosey at the same time. The pirates would leave in the motorized covered lifeboat with the $30,000.
It wasn't anywhere near what the pirates had been hoping for, but it was better than nothing. And with the pirates thinking the U.S. Navy might be closing in, they couldn't afford to risk waiting around and losing everything.
Elmy and Hammock escorted Richard Phillips to his quarters, where he kept the safe. Phillips was still very situationally aware and remembered to talk loudly, just in case any crew members were moving about. Specifically, at this point, Shane Murphy, whom Phillips knew was not in the safe room with the other men.
Meanwhile, the pirates demanded that the lifeboat get extra fuel and food to help them get back to Somalia. The crew thought they had a deal. But the pirates were not about to let millions of dollars slip away that easily.
Shane, Mike, and several other crew members brought Moosey up on deck and made sure that Captain Phillips was unharmed.
The third engineer and bosun loaded up the lifeboat with the requested fuel. Then the two of them launched the lifeboat off the Maersk Alabama into the water.
It seemed like the standoff might be coming to a peaceful end. But this was only the eye of the storm.
While the crew continued to guard Moosey, Richard Phillips got on board the lifeboat to show the other three pirates how to work it. His top priority was getting the pirates off his ship.
The pirates were still keeping Phillips as leverage until they had Moosey. So they took Phillips on board the lifeboat as the third mate and bosun got off. The exchange should have gone like this. Moosey would come down the ladder onto the lifeboat and Phillips would leave.
Phillips radioed Deschain and told him to start the exchange. Moosey would come down first. Moosey had a white piece of cloth around his hand, but he was smiling.
And that's when the pirates double-crossed Phillips. Moosey took the wheel, turned it away from the Maersk, and gunned the lifeboat to top speed.
"What about the deal?" Phillips asked, shocked.
"No deal," said Moosey with a grin. Maybe the warlords would not have accepted $30,000, or maybe the pirates were just greedy. Why would they settle for $30,000 when they could still get a ransom of millions?
Next time on Hostage, we'll take you back on board the lifeboat where Moosey and his pirate crew attempted to make their escape with their sole hostage, Captain Richard Phillips.
The pirates had had a shot at millions of dollars and lost it. How could Richard Phillips survive the pirates' wrath and the mind games? What would Moosey do to try to negotiate from a dramatically weakened position?
Could Moosey get his pirates to the coast of Somalia in safety? And in an uncooled, increasingly hot lifeboat with limited food and water, how could all of them survive?
Find out next week in part 2 of The Maersk, Alabama.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. And if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Greg Macklin and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.